Les conférences du Collège de France.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you, Professor Grenet, for your kind invitation. I am now going to begin the second lecture. If you were not here on the first lecture, and so these four lectures are intertwined. The first one was on the idea of Iran, but its background, mainly looking from Sistan, from the east, and what may have seeped into the province of Fars for its idea. Today, I am going to look squarely on the province of Fars and look at the second element in this creation of the symbiosis of what I say the idea of Iran. And I apologize, it's going to be again, well, it's good because it has pictures, but it will be numismatic based again, so on. Let me begin. So I would not procrastinate. And today, of course, with the title that Professor Grenet mentioned, it's Proustian in some ways, it's about how the Sasanians, a late antique empire, thought about the past. Who was ruling over this land, this Iranian plateau? So, and this past that they think of, we're going to see is a bit different from what we are used to know. At first glance, the idea that memory of the past does not reveal itself to all people in the same manner may seem strange. For the Sasanians in late antiquity, 200 to 700, 220 to 651, what they came to profess as their ancient past, and for the people they were ruling over, was drastically different from what the Romans understood as the history of the past. In a sense, what such historians as von Ranke were attempting to do in the modern era, that is to understand what had really happened in the past, was in line with the Greco-Roman historical tradition of the past two or three centuries. For Iranians of the pre-modern era, and for the Sasanians, a historical tradition had developed which was far removed from the Greek and Roman historiographical tradition. Consequently, history unveiled itself in a different manner in the late ancient Iranian world versus that of the Mediterranean. In a sense, the history of the past as a set of real events, we may say, was balkanized in the world of late antiquity as part of the collective memory of a people. This balkanization of the past led to the creation of a different past where the conflicts and brotherhoods were redefined in nativist terms and brought about internal reasoning in dealing with their neighbors, which I will discuss in lecture four. The most important element in this divergent development of history and memory, here I'm invoking another important, of course, scholar, Jacques Le Goff, was the impact of confessional religions of late antiquity, where their sacred traditions constructed particular histories, which served to explain who they were, where they came from, and why they were here now, for be it the Zoroastrians, the Judeo-Christian tradition, and later the Muslims. I was in Strasbourg with Nina a couple of days ago. I picked up a book and I bought it, L'Histoire Universelle, where a 250-year-old book, Bousset begins his ancient history. What is interesting, it is a melange of biblical, so it starts with Adam and Eve, and then it twines the some Greek, Persian, Roman in there. So this is, of course, for to me as an example, would be something akin to a sort of Christian outlook of how history begins, and so on. In the case of Sasanian Iran Shah, case of Sasanian Iran Shahr, the empire of the Iranians, rather than explaining or even knowing what had in fact happened in the past, the Sasanians wrote their history based on what they thought had happened or should have happened in the past in line with their own tradition. Again, I am invoking another French important scholar of classics, Paul Vian, in his work on belief, truth, and history, has dealt with these very issues in regard to Greek civilization. As he has noted, one must actually speak of truths, and that these truths were themselves product of imagination. Here I take truths as sets of beliefs shaped into history, formed through a collective memory. These truths of the past played out differently in the Mediterranean under the aegis of the Roman Empire than in Mesopotamia and the Iranian plateau and even Central Asia, but also among the many communities within these regions. Of course, these regions were in contact with one another, and there were indeed exchange, but Rome and Iran kept a separate identity and history, however intertwined they were. This memory of the past, invented in the Sasanian period, was to remain in the Iranian historical memory and its tradition until the 19th century, with the decipherment of the Behistun inscription by Henry Rawlinson, which I showed him this morning, and the official entry of Western historical inquiry into Iran, providing for the alteration of existing historiographical tradition. In the morning I mentioned the translation is presented to the Qajar Shah. Here is the history of the past, and the Qajar king is not clear what past this may be. This tradition and Iranian view of history is revealed not only in the books, but also as a pictorial history in the monumental works of the late Qajar period of the early 20th century. For example, at the building known as Tekieh-e Muavin al-Mulk, which I have visited and I think it's really fantastic, constructed during the late Qajar period in the city of Kermanshah, is a perfect visual attestation of Iranian historical narrative and memory. In the backyard of this building, where it is a place of taziyah, where Shiite passion plays are performed, hence it's a well-visited area. Everybody who is part of that community at certain times has visited the place. The walls are decorated with tiles, as you can see. A major section of the building, a part of it, has to do with important Shiite events such as the 680 event and the Shiite Imam Hussein and the Shiite paradigm of his martyrdom. However, there's another section of this building that is unveiling the history of Iran. In this section, each tile depicts a single ruler or an important personage of the Iranian past. The progression of scenes are in line with the great Iranian tradition and the Book of Kings, the Shahnameh, composed in the 11th century, where the names of the kings are written below and their image, well, it's not below. I made a mistake. It's on the top, on the side. The list of kings began with Yima, Jamshid, the primordial or mythical king, and then the Peshdadians, and then the Kianid kings, and are featured as a dynasty, as in the Avesta, where then there's a brief interlude of Alexander, and then there's a mention of Dara, and then a brief mention of the Arsacids. The Sasanian kings and queens take a major portion of the wall, and as they do in the national epic. However, here, the images continue the project of Iran's history all the way up to the Muslim rulers with the very last Qajar Shah, Ahmad Shah. In this scheme, the Achaemenids and the Seleucids, so we're talking about 2 centuries and another century and a half, are completely absent this last time, as I would call it. Unless we count Dara, as the two Dariuses, Darius the founder of the empire and Darius the third, Dorei Doraion as Darius the third. This was indeed how history progressed in the historical memory of the Iranians from the Sasanian period onward. It is in the Qajar period, in the late 19th century, that Western version of history, which revealed Iran's Achaemenid past, became popular. It was then that the Iranian historical memory, or what one calls national history, the invention of the Sasanians, clashed with the Western historical and historiographical tradition. The Western tradition recounted the history of the Greeks and their stance against the mighty Persian Empire, or the mighty Greek city-states versus the great Persian Empire, through the works of Herodotus, Xenophon, and other classical historians. These sources now, from the late 19th century and early 20th century, were started to be read in European languages, mainly French, by educated Iranians such as Moshiro Dole, Hassan Pirnia, which is has penned the most important book for the history of Iran in three volumes, which is, as I mentioned this morning, it keeps on being printed. And this allowed for a new sense of history and an alternative one to be born. From the time of European infiltration of historical knowledge, this dual vision of history of Iranian antiquity has survived in memory and in literature, and both traditions are duly but separately respected and understood. The first narrative is heroic, emotionally charged, is encapsulated in the Shahnameh as best example. The second is monumental, seen through the Western scholarly narrative. And this may seem strange to you, those of the Western audience, but in fact, this multiple vision of the past does exist even until today. But of course, I think it's the creation of the late ancient world. It may appear utterly impossible for the Sasanian Persian Empire, who established an Asiatic empire in contact with the Mediterranean and the Indic world, not to be aware of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. However, this traditional Western dichotomy of Greek, Roman versus Persian, Iranian was the product of European historiographical tradition. The history of ancient Iran was revealed differently for the Iranians, as constructed from memory during the Sasanian period. Indeed, there's almost nothing of the Achaemenid history in the traditional late antique history of Iran outwardly. There are some internal evidences that I think are being presented now more and more. At first, it is necessary to ask us, or ourselves, the question of why Iranians did not possess a historical account of the Achaemenid kings in the late ancient world, and why the mythical Kayanids, as I mentioned in the first lecture, as they appear in the Avesta, took their place in the historiography of the Iranians. So no Achaemenids, but the Kayanids and the Pishtadids. Why would the Greeks and then the Romans remember what had happened, while Iranians chose to forget or outwardly ignore the Achaemenids? Why did the Sasanians instead have their own version of the past, where these Pishtadians and Kayanian dynasties of the Avesta played a major part in Iranian historiography? The great Czechoslovakian scholar Otkar Klima believed that the reason why Iranians did not write history in the same way as the Greeks and the Romans, at least until the early Islamic period, was that the king had absolute power to commission and therefore determine written content of the history for the people. So it's the court that sanctions and that's written. In other words, history was constructed by the court and as an elite royal chronicle. One can agree in some ways with Klima that out of the Iranian tradition, only a kingly chronicle, what is known as Khwadai Namag, the Book of Lords, constructed during the time of Khosrow I in the 6th century, existed. On the other hand, this memory of the past, more than being a reflection of the will of the king or the consent of the royal archives, was the result of the manipulation and redaction of Zoroastrian priestly and scribal narration, who actually helped in writing such a text. So, the reason for the differences between the Greek and Roman historians and what the priests, scribes wrote seems to lie in the fact that the latter, the Zoroastrian religion, provided an important avenue for viewing the past. Consequently, what the Zoroastrian tradition had created as a sacred narrative very much determined the memory of the king and the people. So, our inquiry begins with how the Sasanians saw their past and their ancestors or forefathers. If the Achaemenids are not their forefathers, what is in Middle Persian called Ahinegan, then who is their Ahinegan? For modern historians, the Thisbid Achaemenid Empire were the first historical Persian dynasty of this Iranian world, well known. Of course, there were the Medes before them, but here is a real empire, as Pierre Briand says. However, this knowledge is a product of classical historiographical tradition, where the Greeks, of course, were facing this, Greek city-states were facing these important sort of new great power, the Achaemenid dynasty, with its ceremonial center at Persepolis in the province of Fars during the beginning of this East-West confrontation. After about five centuries, well, less than that, but almost 3.5 centuries, after the fall of the Achaemenids, during which non-Persians, such as the Macedonians, Seleucids, and the Parthians ruled the Iranian plateau, which is more than 5 centuries, sorry. Again, another Persian dynasty, the Sasanians, established their control beyond Persis over what came to be called, as I mentioned, Iran Shahr. In 224, the Sasanians inherited the position of the Arsacids as the rivals to the Roman Empire. The Roman historians then followed on the tradition established by the Greek historians, and as required by the political competition, portrayed the Sasanians in the same light as the Achaemenids. Consequently, in this Western construct of history, Asia was dominated by the same Persians from antiquity, from the Achaemenid Persian Empire till the coming of the Sasanians. It is thus assumed that if the Romans knew of the Greeks, then the Sasanians should have known about the Achaemenid heritage. But the Achaemenid Empire had gone much further in terms of its limit than what the Sasanians called Iran Shah, the Empire of Iranians. And a cursory look at the limits of Darius's empire, as he mentions himself, and I am not going to read this for you, for the sake of time. Otherwise, we will have Professor Azanush read the Persian, Dariavush Khashayaitia, Zarka Khashayaitia, Khashayaitia, Nam Khashayaitia, Dahyunam Bah, Vishtasbah, Yapuhla, and so on. And then we go. But what all in all Darius is telling us is he has a great empire, and the four corners in a diagonal way is mentioned here. From the Scythians are in Sogdiana, and then it goes back to Nubia, Africa. So it's really showing a huge Afro-Eurasian empire at work here. During, and this is really its largest extent when we talk about the Achaemenid Empire. So the Achaemenids left an indelible mark on the memory of many of these people who were conquered or were part of the empire, especially the Greeks, the Hebrews, and the Egyptians. As we shall see below, these people will prop up this memory of the past during the Sasanian period in one way or another. In Africa, the Egyptians, during the Sasanian occupation 619-628, resulted in a reaction in writing by the Copts, these are Christian Egyptians, seeing the invasion or the occupation of the Persians, Sasanian Persians, in light of the Achaemenid invasion in 525 BCE. This was, as I mentioned, mainly due to the fact that Coptic narrative of that existed at the time of Cambyses' conquest existed in late antiquity and was known at the time and used in response to this reconquista, if you may say, of the Persians. One can only wonder how the Coptic Egyptians informed the Iranian military and officers of their ancestors and what had happened in the past. When the Sasanians under Shapur I, the ruler between 240 and 270 CE, attempted to counter Roman incursions in the Near East, he and his, of course, forces took such cities as Hatra in 240, Dura Europus in 256. The synagogue at Dura, which is of interest for many reasons, Mithraism, but here for another reason, between gates 18 and 19, we face several Middle Persian graffiti, which is indicative of Sasanian officers that were taken by the Jews to the site to observe, and Middle Persian nigirid of these images or negars. The Purim scene, where the Achaemenid ruler is sitting on the throne, if we take Ahasuerus either as Xerxes or Artaxerxes, traditionally Xerxes, the Iranian scribes, having come with Shapur's forces, stated that they saw and liked the images. So there is here a direct scene of this charge d'affaires being taken and shown. And you wonder what was being told by the Jewish representatives to the Persian soldiers. And you can sort of read part of this. This Judo-Iranian connection of bygone age must have been invoked by the Jews of Dura, linking the history of the Jewish Iranians in a way that must have been mutually understood by both. It is not far-fetched that Sasanian officers and scribes would have understood this scene through Iranian pictorial tradition. Xerxes was a Persian king, and Jews must have related the story of part of this common tradition and bound between the two people from antiquity together. It is clear that the Jews living under the Sasanian rule were in contact with the Sasanian administration, the elite, and even the court. Evidence is the Babylonian Talmud, where the Persians are present in many ways after the, of course, the Jews have moved to Mesopotamia. The Persians were seen as restorers initially, and the Romans were seen as the destroyers. Hence, the association of the rabbis and the Sasanian kings are quite revealing. In the Talmud, for example, some of the rabbis confront others because these rabbis have too much of a close relation to the court. They wear, as the sources say, they wear the Persian hat and the belt, kolah ut kamar. And these are signs of status, signs of power. And the Jews are doing this. And so we know there is that type of interaction. But again, Talmudic passages discuss how my colleague Simcha Gross has written on this, that for this one or two Sasanian kings, only a Jewish rabbi who was present at the court would cut a quince for him and would be allowed to sort of split fruit with him. This, of course, is just a simple measure of saying that there is interaction. When reading through what has been called non-religious Middle Persian texts produced in the Sasanian period, if that is really non-religious, one can see a close relation between the Sasanian monarch and their Jewish subjects. Let me go further, because this is a long read, and I don't want to read the entire thing. Here in this Middle Persian text called the Shahrasana Iran Shah, the provincial capitals of Iran Shah, there are two passages that are quite interesting. The city of Khwarazm was built by Narseh, the son of Juas. So here's one Sasanian king who seems to be a son, whose mother is Jewish. But there's another section. The city of Susa and Shushta were built by Shishindok, the wife of Yazgir, the son of Shapur, since she was the Resh Kalut, the leader of the exile, the king of the Jews, and also the mother of Bahram Gur. So apparently in this sort of Jewish tradition, Bahram Gur is given a Jewish mother. Now, if this is reality or not is a matter of discussion. Again, my colleague Simcha Gross has recently written on this and sort of why Jews would suggest such a thing, either in the early Islamic period or late Sasanian world. But on the face of it, at least we're seeing that there is some sort of tacit understanding, and these priests are writing that their mother were Jewish. And there is, I just want to show that type of interaction between the hierarchy of Jewish and sort of Persian nobility or upper classes. We find similar evidence for the Bible, where Zoroastrians and Iranians and Christians are interacting, and so the biblical tradition of the Achaemenids again is there. Even closer is the Armenian tradition. The important historian Yerishe tells us that during Yazgir II in the 5th century, the court and the king were told about the stories of the Bible regarding the Persians and the treatment of the Jews by the Achaemenid Persians. Translations of the Bible seem to have existed in Middle Iranian, probably the work of Christian missionaries in the Iranian Empire and Central Asia. Additionally, their Judo-Persian tradition is quite rich about the Achaemenids, and as I mentioned, the Talmud. So it makes sense that there was avenues of understanding. For these reasons, most historians have not hesitated to think that the Sasanians may have remembered the Achaemenid Persians. Several historians, however, have taken an opposite view and against this issue, that what we are being told is the product of classical historiographical tradition. Beginning with the great scholar Theodor Nuldecke, this tradition was in motion, and I really don't want to talk about historiography because that will bore everybody, but there's been scholars and that you can read in the writings as it's published. But whether there are some scholars who believe that they remember it or not, what can we find? Well, in the 4th century in the Sasanian Empire, Shapur Sagan Shah, on his way to the court from Sistan, stayed at Persepolis, the ceremonial capital of the Persians, and left an inscription in Middle Persian, which demonstrates his devotion to this complex. Again, a very long read, but he comes there, he goes and eats, and sort of praises the gods and whoever has made this place. Again, no mention specifically of who these people are, but there's a tacit understanding, at least we know that it's someone or people to be respected. And that is, I think, what is important here. And they know the place called Satsutun, or a 100-column place. So there is some interesting sort of nitty-gritty ideas here, and the retinue is quite large and interesting. How could it be that the Sasanians left us inscriptions at the Achaemenid palace complex of Persepolis, blessing the monument's builders and leaving largest cluster of rock reliefs below the Achaemenid tombs in Nashir Rostam, and yet not know about the Achaemenids? How is it possible that some of the people who lived around and inside the empire remember the Persians, Achaemenid Persians, but we are to believe that the Sasanians themselves were oblivious to this historical memory? Still, it was only recently that by utilizing textual classical Middle Persian and other evidence that recent, meaning 1970s is recent for us. It was Ehsan Yarshater who first, I think, provided a very interesting idea, and then followed by Erich Kettenhofen, the late Zev Ruben, and Michael Rove, that each demonstrated in their own craft, archaeology, history, Iranology, that we shouldn't simply assume that the Sasanians remembered the Achaemenids. And Yarshater, whose article is most famous in a conference in Rome in 1969, which was published in 1970, where he states that if the Sasanians actually had no knowledge of the Achaemenids, and if they had knowledge of anyone, it would have been the Arsacids. And those were the ones that they would have remembered. Erich Kettenhofen dealt with the problem from the classical sources, quoting Ardashir and his son Shapur's statement and aspirations in their in what they were trying to show. And we're going to see one of those very shortly. Scholler believes that whatever the Sasanians may have known about the Achaemenids were via the religious tradition of Zoroastrianism. And this makes very good sense, which was limited essentially being confined to the story of Daraya Darayan, to the Darais, but which Darais? And Alexander, obviously. I shall discuss this Daraya Darayan. In order to better understand what Erich Kettenhofen is saying, we can look at the statement supposedly made by Shapur II in the 4th century against the Romans when they were making the incursion. And basically, the inscription says, all of this land in Anatolia, up to the sea, belonged to us by our ancestors. So what is going on is that the Romans are automatically, through their tradition, saying, okay, oh, they mean the Achaemenids. They just want to actually create the Achaemenid Empire. And Kettenhofen has shown, in a really interesting way, that this is really the product of classical historiography. We cannot find this voice in the Persian sources. And if we can't, and if this seems as such, we don't know if the Sasanians really were claiming that they wanted to take back the land as the Achaemenids had. Rahim Shaygan also has succinctly demonstrated the process which Roman historiography vis-a-vis the Iranian provided two different views of the world. Of course, another possibility is that the Sasanian kings were making territorial claims here, as you see, but not based on Achaemenid traditional history, and I shall speak of that on the fourth lecture, rather than alternative traditions that existed in Iran. Indeed, some of the territories claimed by the Sasanians is clear in the inscriptions of Shapur, for example. These claims seem to be more against the Romans as during the Arsacid period, when the Romans began, in fact, the last century of Arsacid rule, Romans began to creep into Mesopotamia, establishing their provinces. And what the Persians are really trying to do, the Sasanians, just to push them back. And what they're trying to say that we're going to take that, where Euphrates, during my lecture, was the first one, was the boundary. They're trying to actually push them back and perhaps try to take Syria. And this has also been, I think, discussed by Philip Huysa with the similar conclusion on Sasanian propaganda. In fact, even if we are to posit the notion that there was certainly notions of the Achaemenids circulating among the various groups within the Sasanian Empire, there is still not a single Sasanian source or Sasanian-inspired source, that suggests an understanding of this Achaemenid past as there it exists in the Greco-Roman tradition. So that is while there may be the idea of great kings of old, Dara, and what keeps being propped up, Daraya Darayan, and Dara, Dara Ben Dara, in the post-Sasanian world. But what does that really mean? In line with Ammianus, there are other historians, Herodian, 4th century Roman historian, repeat this same verbose attempt of taking over what was theirs according to their ancestors. But who are these Ainagan? Again, who are these people in the past? And here's Ammianus's sort of report on Shapur II, which I think I have missed here. If the Sasanians were not informed of the Achaemenids or did not invoke them in their propaganda against their enemies, the question must be, how did this historical amnesia come to prominence? And what was put in place as the historical memory of this past? To begin with, were the Achaemenids accidentally forgotten? Or was there a planned program to provide an alternative history? Rather than just denying or confirming Sasanian memory of the Achaemenids, something that has been done now for the past 50 years, I would like to suggest that the process was much more complicated and there were several streams of history and memory working together to bring about a new past in late antiquity. It is quite possible that through some indigenous streams of memory in Fars, in the province of Persis, the Sasanians could have introduced the Achaemenids. Let us look at the late antique Zoroastrian Middle Persian evidence for this history. In the Bundeshan, chapter 33, sorry, I don't have water, you're going to see a list of a number of rulers, people who are shown in the interlude of this. It's a chapter on all the disasters that befell Iran, but in fact it is giving a progression of history according to 8th, 9th century Zoroastrian encyclopedia. As you can see, the Achaemenids are missing. And there's a mention of Vahman, son of Spandiyah, Dara, son of Dara. Alexander appears, who is called Hurumayig, Roman. So you could see the propaganda of the Roman side on this one. And then appears Ardashir, the founder of the Sasanian Empire. Then where is the Achaemenid history? In fact, I believe what we may be seeing here is an exposition of the history of Iranian plateau, and more specifically, Fars in an anachronistic manner. To understand these two passages and the idea of Daras, who are these Daras, which may take away from the Achaemenid Dariuses, we must turn to the historical tradition between the Seleucid rule and the end of the Arsacids. So we're talking about this period. It is the work of Josef Wiesehofer and his study of what is called the Dark Ages of Persis, the province of Fars, until the coming of the Arsacids and then the Sasanians, we are beginning to get a better idea of what was going on there in this red area, obviously, the province of Fars. And the history of this region, from the Seleucid through the Arsacids in the province, is divided into two dynastic or groups of people. The first groups are called the Fratarakas. The second one are the Persian kings, the Malka, which I spoke last time. About Manucher 1, 2, 3 last time. So those are later, those are the Malkas. But before that are the Fratarakas. We call it Frataraka governorship if we want to. While the Seleucids early on controlled the province of Fars, only too soon they allowed a group under the name of the Fratarakas to at least have nominal control of the affairs in Persis at the end of the 2nd century BC, perhaps even at the in the 3rd century BC. Although the relations to the Seleucid overlords is a matter of dispute, one has to only look at the last of these, who's called Vahbars or Vorzes, which represents slaying a Macedonian ruler. And it has been suggested that the noble exception to Svahbard's coinage at the turn of the 2nd century BCE, so 2nd century BCE, who has the title of Karin or Karnos, and the killing of the Macedonian signals some sort of a break from the past, if this is the last of these fratarkas. The exact sequence of these fratarka rulers has been a matter of dispute, and again, I'm not going to go through Selwood, Alram, Wiesehofer, Vestakertis, Sahosh, Kluse, and Musler, numismatists, historians, artists, all have sort of tried to create a sequence. I am taking, which is now mostly accepted, the work of Sonia Pilschke, where this sequence appears to be Ardashir, Vahbars, Baidad, Vodfradad, and Vodfradad the second. And the last one has at least some sort of a probable date here. It is believed that Vodfradad the second's coins were minted as sub-kings, having his allegiance to the Arsacid kings after the defeat of Demetrius II. That is, by the time of Vodfradad II in 140 BC, the Arsacids were now the rulers and in control of Persis. Now, I mentioned here that we have such a coinage, but what about other fratarkas? I just want you to see, and this is, of course, a pet peeve of the numismatist, you see two fratarka coinage, but if you look closely, they're overstrikes. Overstrikes in antiquity meant that you're trying to negate the previous regime. So here is Mr. Zuhurian's coinage that he kindly gave me. I think it's an overstrike of Alexander. So that was a coinage line that, poof, they put one. And here we have another overstrike of Seleucus I, another one. This in itself, I think, means much in terms of where these fratarkas stand in their ideology vis-a-vis their Seleucid overlords. So if this is at least the common for now scheme of Ardashir and Tuvod Fradad, for the meaning of what is written on the coin, Dr. Shervo has sort of been groundbreaking in this manner, where he translates it as the Fratrake Baron, as head, prior, superior, first, ahead of the outstanding among gods. But there are other people. There have been suggestions by Astheimer of Henning and Helmut Hombach that these are the governors, who the governor who is lord. We have others who mention, as we saw, that fratarka, meaning God, governor of the lords. Basically, they're in charge, but we don't know in what status they are. We should ask, what does this baron mean? And Antonio Panaina, in a, as he would say in his stimulating article, a very long one, has asked, are we talking about governors to Ahura Mazda, these Baron or the gods, or the Baron are to be taken as a pluralis maestatis, a plural for majesty, referring to the kings to whom the Fratarka were subject, or to the Achaemenids who were there before? Antonio Panaino believes that we do not have compelling evidence that the Persian Fratarkas became divine, nor claimed divine descent after the fall of the Achaemenid dynasty. And so they may just be as that, governors. But the imagery, of course, doesn't bother me. But when you're sitting on a throne that looks very Achaemenid, you're holding an Achaemenid staff, and most importantly, you're putting on the coat, as we were told in the Greek tradition, that each king, before to make the epiphany, the new kings had to wear this coat, and a flag that I'm going to talk about, all sounds more than just governorship. But that's just my reading of what may be here at work. Another point of the Fratarkas has to do with what Abdi Young has called the cultic banner, which is important for historical memory and continuity, or the lack of it, and transformation. The banner appears sometimes with tassels. As you can see here, it's a more crude strike, but the reason I put this is that there's a bird on top of it. The banner appears to be important, but how old is it? Did it belong to the Achaemenids? Here, one can look at the Alexander mosaic depicting the pivotal moment of the battle between Alexander and Darius III, where the scene shows on the Persian side, am I seeing this correctly? Is the banner there, Franz? Yes. And thanks to Franz, who supplied at night, in the middle of the night, articles and books to me, of Carl Nylander, a detail shows where the Persian banner, apparently, as Franz told me, is not, these are not Macedonians, they're Persians. It is the head of a bird. And the question is, what bird? Shapur Shahbazi was the only one that I know that had mentioned and written an article on the Varagna, or this bird of prey, which he connects to the Bahram Yasht. As we've discussed with Franz, it's not really clear. So I would even think of Homaya, Sin more, less, or the Bahram. That is a matter of, I think, interpretation. And here is a reconstruction of it, as it is seen through this work. And of course, this will become part of this tradition of the Drafshe Kaviani, the Kianian sort of flag in time. In the Sasanian historical tradition, such as the Bundation and the other one, the rule of Vahman, descendant of Kavishtas, is when all legitimate male heirs are killed. And a woman, do I have Homai here? Oops, somehow has disappeared, but that's okay. Becomes a ruler. The narrative then mentions a ruler named Daraya Darayan, presumed to be Darius III, later defeated by Alexander. Alexander then burns the sacred text, the Zoroastrian, the Avesta, and sends a copy to Rome. This is sort of the traditional Zoroastrian history. While the Arsacids receive the shortest treatment in these Middle Persian texts, then the focus goes to Ardashir I and the succeeding Sasanian kings. And as it was mentioned, I think, by Franz and Samra Zanush last time, it's interesting that Ardashir, the founder of the Sasanians, receives a lukewarm treatment, not only in Dinkard 4, which Carlo Cerretti has written something on as well, but also in the Name Tansar. There is this resistance against this new king. And the king has to provide the genealogy. What kind of genealogy? Right here. He says, at least he is Ardashir the Kianites, a one mythical dynasty, son of Papak. There's Papak, his father. From the parentage of Sasan, which we talked in the first lecture, is it a protective deity or not? From the lineage of King Dara. I'm really stuck on this Dara and Darai Darayan. Sasan was our first one, and now Dara is my second lecture. This array of titlature and genealogical connections reflect a late Sasanian perspective on ancestry. Here, Ardashir is known as a Kianit, corresponding to the late Sasanian preoccupation with this Kianian dynasty. Nevertheless, what can be said about these titles is that the Middle Persian texts mention another Ardashir. Do I have it? Yes. And that is Ardashir K. This is not, I think, the Ardashir that we're talking about as the ruler of the Sasanians, but he is Ardashir the Kianit, who will be called Vahman, the son of Spandiot. And this Ardashir K has been identified with Artaxerxes II. Am I correct, Franz? I think you have it in your History of Zoroastrianism, Volume 3, page 385, as well as an article by Said Amir Arjumand on Artaxerxes, Ardashir, and Bahman, where that identification is made. And I'm going to respectfully try to provide another identification with this Ardashir K. So Who is this Ardeşire? Okay. I would like to suggest that it is possible that this Ardeşire K is the Ardeşir, the founder of the Fratarika dynasty. And so I will go now. Who I'm talking about, I have to count to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, I'm talking about this, the founder of this Fratarika dynasty. So in the Zoroastrian text, there is a faint hint of the founder of the Fratarikas, if that sequence is correct. That is the Ardeşir K, in my sort of opinion. This would mean that Ardeşir was striking coins in Persis at the beginning of the 3rd century BC during the rule of the Seleucids. It is important to note that on his coin, Ardeşir has an upright tiara, which may suggest political aspirations. And this fact would not have escaped, of course, the notice of the Greco-Macedonians. May it not be that Ardeşir, the K, also could have represented this Zoroastrian, and become part of the Zoroastrian Iranian past? So this is my big wow moment, but we'll leave that at here. Here, we must also note the existence of others in this Bundahishan chronology. We mentioned Homai, and the Homai is that's Ardeşir coinage, and you can see on the reversed some form of emulation, and it's been either called a fire altar, but here these Merlins, I think, make sense in some ways, very much. And I'm running out of time, so that's why I'm sort of timing myself. And I didn't do a very good job. We have Homai, oops, how did this jump? Which is mentioned in the Bundahishan chronology. And I think she is the connecting linchpin between the Fratarikas and the next Persis kings who are going to come. These Daras, who are really important for my, I think, at least, discussion. This makes, I think, sense for the province of Persis. And this Homai, her name appears in various different ways. In the Tabari, in his history, when Ardeşir meets his brother, there's an accident. It's divine sort of providence that the rock falls on Shapur, and Ardeşir sort of becomes the king. So you get all sorts of interesting things associated with Persepolis and such names. To give further weight to such chronological advance, I would like to again look at these Persis coins, but only really in this chronology of Darai I, Ardeşir II, Vahşir III, and Darai II, and Wad Fradad. I would like to deal with the Darayan and the Daras. Two bowls have been found that have an inscription, and these are rather recent. Muhammad Rahim Shaygan, in an important article, based on reading of an inscription of a J. Paul Getty Museum collection of a bowl, which I think we saw during a exhibition, and more recently, I think, from the Al-Sabah collection, if I'm not making a mistake, Nicholas Sims Williams has done a reading, but I'm taking Rahim's emendation. It reads on it, may I Ardeşir or Ardeşir, the earlier descendant of Darayan, be happy. This hammered bull is gold and silver, weight 50 staters. It belongs to Prince Vahşur. Here, Ardeşir makes a very important mention of his Ahiyan Darayagan. That is the Middle Persian Ahinag, descendant of Dara. Hence, we may be viewing altogether a new dynasty named Darayanagan. That is from Dara the First to Dara the Second. And I think it's these Darayan that we may be seeing in Middle Persian tradition being invoked by the Sasanians. in the genealogy of, for example, Ardeshir, where he is from Daraya Darayan, but also, I can't read anymore. Do I see a Naf here? Yeah. Nafe Darai Shah, from the decision of King Dara. So I think it is this Daraya Darayan, the two Daras of the province of Fars, that are the point of emulation, but also a matter of remembrance. At the end, I would like to focus on the focal point of Persianate memory, that is Pars or Persepolis. This monument, of course, was a place of grandeur, and after it was burnt by Alexander, it still remained a moment or a point of history and memory, what Pierre Noah calls memorialization. So this place has significance. As a structure, it embodies some memory. And what is on it, obviously, is quite important. It's architectural design, and what's on it is certainly important. And here's this graffitis that we find on Persepolis, which have been called early Sasanian. They have been called early Sasanian. This is the story of the divine intervention. This was a part of Tabari that I did not mention last time, of the two brothers having an accident. But my final slide is what has made me think and what I want to show. I had the chance to be at Persepolis and make some copies of these very small incisions. And everyone was talking about these are Sasanians. And I'm wondering, you have 3rd and 4th century monumental rock reliefs. Why would the Sasanians start putting these very 4-inch incisions into walls that are very difficult to see? That one, it has to be night, you have to put on the flashlight. And to my mind, that doesn't make sense. I don't think these are Sasanians. In fact, what we're seeing is the kings of Persis, the Malkas, who see this structure as something of bygone eras and important, come and put their reliefs. And so in this, I do not see an early Sasanian. I rather see Darayan. This is Dara the second, Daraya Darayan. So I think the Darayanids, in fact, were a group that came and became the ancestors of the Sasanians. The knowledge of the Sasanians in terms of their past, I think, goes back to Ardashir, or Ardashir, of Frataraka, and really more recently to these Darayanids who were ruling over the province of Fars, and not that came another way. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.